So nice to see you all again here. And recently I've been doing all of these workshops on Saturdays here, but now is a chance to give a more general Dhamma talk, which is great because it's a bit different from giving structured teachings. But before I say anything else, it happens to be my mother's birthday today. And if I don't tell her happy birthday, I'll be really in big trouble. So, Mom, if you're watching this, happy birthday. Back in Norway. I hope you are well here. So I, if she hasn't been watching this, I will send her the link, so make sure she watches this later on here. So I thought tonight I was going to talk a little bit about some of the problems in the world and how to deal with these problems from a Buddhist point of view, and how to think about them in a way that is constructive, and what we can do about some of these things. What are the Buddhist attitudes to some of the problems we see in the world? And one of those problems that we are seeing right now, we have seen the problems in Myanmar, in Burma, with the military kind of taking over the government and people protesting in the streets and then people being killed by the military. And this, of course, is a very anti-Buddhist way of behaving, people killing, getting killed and all of this. So the question is, what can we do? And one of the things that, of course, is on my mind is, what can I do as a monk? What would I do if I was in Burma and the military came up and said, okay, behave, pointing a gun at you or something like that? And one of the interesting things that you find in the Buddhist suttas, the Buddhist discourses and the Buddhist Vinaya, is precisely this interaction between the monastics and the lay people, especially when there are times of trouble. And this times of trouble, of course, the world was no different at the time of the Buddha than it is now. The world is pretty much the same. Maybe we are a little bit less spiritual, so maybe we have gone a bit backwards since the time of the Buddha. People like to think we're going forwards, right? But I think sometimes actually we go backwards, in things like spirituality. There's no obvious reason why we're going forward in spirituality. Might very well go backwards. Who knows? And certainly at the time of the Buddha, things were quite different from what they are now. But anyway, so because the problems are largely the same, what happened if the lay people were behaving really badly? Let's say they were saying bad things about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and they were really doing bad things towards the monks and nuns and whatever, then what do you do? And the Buddha laid down a procedure that you can do as a monastic, which is called the procedure of turning the bowl upside down. Does that sound scary? It's pretty scary. It may not sound scary, but if you are a Buddhist, if you are a real Buddhist from a Buddhist country, it's a really scary thing, because what it means, I don't know if maybe not all of you have probably seen us. Yeah, we have an alms bowl. That is where people put food in our alms bowl, and that's what we eat for the day. And in traditional Buddhist country, you go into the village, people put food in your bowl, and that's what you then have for your lunch. And we do it here as well in Serpentine, but here it's more like a ritual, because it's not really required, but it's a nice ritual. It creates a kind of connection between the monastic sangha and the lay people. So you are allowed, as a Buddhist monastic, when you go into the village and people want to put food in your bowl, you're allowed to show them the bottom of your bowl. Turn your bowl upside down. So imagine. Imagine this happening to you. You're standing there in line, you want to put some food into the monk's bowl, and he or she, the nun, turns the bowl upside down. They walk past you. As soon as they pass, you turn it right way up again and receive food from the next person. How would you feel? I asked the lady the other day, I said, how would you feel? I wouldn't care, it wouldn't bother me. That's what she said. And I was a bit deflated when I heard that answer. I thought, gee, that's really pretty kind of cool. But the reality is that most Buddhists, especially in traditional Buddhist countries, but I think even in Australia, if you are a Buddhist and a monk or nun turned their bowl upside down when they came to you, you'd be a bit sort of, whoa, what's going on? You wouldn't be very happy with that. So it's actually a very powerful statement. It's almost a rejection of the person from the Buddhist religion. You can't take part in one of the most important rituals, one of the most important sharings between the monastic community and the lay people. It's almost as if you are disenfranchised what's the word in the Catholic Church? You are, what's the word? excommunicated. That's exactly the word I was looking for. You're excommunicated, yeah, because you're not given a chance to take part in one of those fundamental rituals that is part and parcel of the connection between the monastic community and the lay people. So people get really offended. And in Burma, the Sangha decided to do this against the military. This is what it did many years ago for the first time. And the military caused a real big consternation in the military in Burma. Yeah, they were really concerned about this. It's a very serious thing. So this is one of those things that we can use as monastics. Yeah, it's a very powerful symbol. You're not allowed to give an offering to the Sangha. Usually, as monastics, we should accept all offerings. Yeah, except for Rolex watches, Rolls Royce cars. You know, there are a few exceptions, but not whiskey. Yeah, if not whiskey, not so much whiskey. Sometimes people give whiskey to monks. I'm sure Ajahn Brahm has told this story many times when there was someone that came up with this big hamper of food and offered Ajahn Brahm, "Here you are, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, thank you." And Ajahn Brahm looked into the hamper, and at the bottom there was a bottle of whiskey here. And so he asked, "Well, why are you offering whiskey to a monk? What's this all about? What are you thinking? And he said, "Oh, my dad recently passed away, and he's up in heaven, and he really likes whiskey, so I offer the monk so he can have whiskey in heaven, because when you offer whiskey to the monks, that's what you get, the people who have departed get in heaven." Yeah, it doesn't actually work like that, yeah? So please don't think like that. So like, imagine if you have a junkie as someone passed away, that might probably be very scary. What would happen then? So this is a very powerful thing, this idea of offering, but offering the right things, of course. And as a monastic, if people offer the right thing, you're almost supposed to receive it, yeah, with gratitude, a sense of appreciation that someone is making that gesture and supporting you as a monastic. Yeah. It's a very powerful thing in Buddhism. And when you stop someone from doing an offering, it's as if you are stopping them from doing one of the fundamental things that is the very beginning of the Buddhist path. Yeah, generosity is at the very foundation of the Buddhist path. And you're stopping them from doing that, it means you're hindering them in even getting going on the Buddhist path. You are disenfranchising and excommunicating them and also stopping them from practice the basic things of Buddhism. It's like a double whammy. It's a really very negative, powerful negative thing here. And so the idea of generosity, yeah, is so important and fundamental in Buddhism. And I would really recommend you, you know, of course, try to develop your own generosity. But one of the things that I often find in the world is that people are very often quite good at being generous. You find people who volunteer, who do things for others, and they really enjoy that. But then the day comes when they are sick. Yeah, they need something. And they refuse. Yeah, oh no, I want to be independent. But please accept from people. Yeah, if people want to support you, they want to help you if you are sick or whatever, allow them to support you, allow them to nurse you, to give to you, whatever it is. Because everyone needs to give. Yeah, this is one of those basic things on the Buddhist path. So don't feel proud about being sick. Oh no, I'm too, you know, my ego doesn't allow me to receive. Please don't do that. If you can give, you should also be able to receive. Otherwise, there is an imbalance there, which is very, very kind of negative. So allow this to happen, because it is so important in Buddhism to act with generosity. And in fact, you will be surprised how important it is. Yeah, the more powerful your meditation is, the more insight you have into the Buddhist teaching, the more open-hearted you are, the more giving you are as a person. One of the things I discovered fairly recently was the connection between some of the words for generosity in Buddhism and the words for enlightenment. Yeah? Enlightenment and generosity share certain vocabulary. It's kind of astonishing to even know that. There is a Pali word called chaga, which means like giving up, yeah? Mutti, like releasing, yeah? Vosagga, he's sitting here. Vosagga, yeah, so his name is also connected with generosity, yeah? His name is Vosagga, but for short we call him Vosaggaramana. Is that right? Well, I do that anyway, because it's a term of endearment, Vosaggaramana, and it kind of rolls off the tongue very nicely, so we call him that. But please tell me off, Venerable Vosagga, if I go too far with these names. So, yeah, and all of the... Good, okay. All of these terms are related. You find them in generosity, and you also find them for awakening here. So there's a connection between generosity and awakening here. Isn't that kind of really amazing? Generosity seems like such a basic thing. Oh, here you are, yeah? And then awakening seems like something really, really lofty. But there is something very profound and similar between these two things. And what is similar is the idea of letting go, yeah? Giving something up, not holding on to things, not thinking, this is me, this is mine, keep your hands off, yeah? Me. It's the opposite. It's giving away and feeling the joy, the beautiful experience that comes from giving with an open heart. And that giving up is exactly the same thing you do when you reach awakening. Awakening is an experience of profound letting go of everything. So the basic principle is the same, but they are at different ends of the spectrum. One is at the beginning, the other one is at the end. So when you give with an open heart, just giving because you love to give, you have an idea of what awakening is all about. Yeah, giving up, letting go of things. This is what awakening is, and also giving. Isn't that kind of cool? Yeah. These things are really nice. Yeah, something so simple and yet so profound at the same time. So this is the first thing that, as a monk, we can do in a situation when things are wrong. Yeah, as monks, we're not supposed to really get involved in politics. Once you get involved in politics, it gets very tricky. You get corrupted very fast. People don't like you because if you take one stand, the other people will hate you for that. So you lose all your half your disciples. They go. So that Dhammaloka, all those people on that side will be gone, but those people still be here. Yeah, So it's not a good idea for monastics to be part of politics, to stand above that a little bit. But these then are ways you can still be involved without actually taking a direct political stand. What is another way? What more can we do? If you are in Burma, for example, what can you do? And one of the things that we should always do as monastics, one of our basic duties is to teach the Dhamma. Yeah. So when someone is using violence, you can say, especially if someone asks you or they want to give a teaching, you can say, this is against the Dhamma. You shouldn't be using violence. And if people are Buddhist, they will take that to heart. They will listen. Yeah, they will take that to heart and they will actually pull back a little bit because of that. The word of someone in an authority position of authority, and monastics are often in the position of have a certain degree of authority, especially in many traditional Buddhist countries. But even here in Perth, yeah, you have a degree of authority as a monastic, and you have to use it wisely, of course. It has impact when you say these things. Yeah, and if you say, and the military gets to hear that the monk says, oh, violence goes against the Buddhist ideas, yeah, and you quote the passage and you show what the Buddha said and you make it very clear and precise, the military leaders also will shrink back because of that. It will have a good effect. But sometimes the opposite happens. Because the monastics are involved in politics, they justify the violence, yeah, of the leaders. That's when it goes really wrong. But this, if you look at Buddhist history, it has happened on a number of occasions. And as soon as there is a precedent in Buddhist history, then in the present generation, they will point to that precedent. Also, they did it 2,000 years ago, so it must be okay, so we will do the same thing now. And they forget about the teachings, and instead they follow some foolish precedent from the past. So it's very important that we bring these things back up, remind people Buddhism is a non-violent religion. Violence is never justified. It is always very negative and very bad. I was in Hong Kong about a year and a half ago, or something like that, and I was in this kind of situation. And I was teaching a retreat, and at the end of every day, you have questions and answers. You get this basket of questions. Yeah, you pick up one question, and very soon, a question comes up. Yeah, this was after the big troubles were started in Hong Kong, and all the riots in the streets and all of that. And the first question that came up was, well, these rioters, they are terrible. They're kind of full of violence. Yeah, what's your opinion about this? it was obvious they wanted me to take a stance, yeah, stance about, you know, these rioters should be, you know, shouldn't act like this, and they are bad, and they should like behave according to law and order. That was the first question. The second question that came, or soon afterwards, was all of this, the government is terrible, yeah, the government is really bad, they're using violence against ordinary people, huh? Was the exact opposite, and they wanted, now they wanted me to support the rioters against the government, and then the government against the rioters. And you can see, you can never win in that kind of situation. The only thing you can do is stand back and teach Buddhist principles. So I said, the right thing to do is to be nonviolent. The right thing to do is to treat people with respect and with care. That is the right thing to do, whether you are the people on the street or you are the government, the police or whatever. Everyone needs to live in the right way. That is the right answer. So you never take a political stance. Instead, you take a Dhamma stance. You base yourself on the Buddhist teaching and the Dhamma. And it's extraordinarily how powerful it is when you do that. I remember reading a survey that was done a few years ago about what kind of demonstrations work in this world. Yeah, and they had a survey that went over 200 or 300 years, something like that, looked at all the demonstrations in a large number of different countries. And what they found was that the peaceful demonstrations were far more effective in bringing about change than violent demonstrations. Yeah, peaceful demonstrations work, whereas violent demonstrations don't. That is what it proved. And it's very obvious why that is the case. Yeah, because when you are peaceful, when you show that you care for everyone, yeah, whatever side they're on, when you show that, you get the goodwill of people around you. People will support you. They will say, yeah, you're doing the right thing. You're living in a good way. You're not going too far. Whereas once you start to become violent, people will turn away. They won't be interested in your message anymore because they will be scared and disappointed by your violence. So it's actually very powerful, yeah, this idea of being peaceful in demonstration. And actually, it turns people's hearts and they follow you. So this is always the best way to act. Yeah, it always brings the best results. So I would then say that, you know, if you are, you know, sometimes you may take the side against the military because the military seems to be so strong compared to these poor demonstrators. But actually, the demonstrators themselves, they make a mistake if they're violent. Never be violent. It is always wrong, regardless of which side you're on. That is really the message here. So this is the second thing that we should do as Buddhist monastics, teach the Dhamma. Yeah, and this is very important. Is there anything beyond that we can do? And one of the last things that we can perhaps do, and this may perhaps be a little bit more surprising, and that has to deal with how we should govern our societies. Yeah, should we govern our societies? Does Buddhism have any preference whether you have a dictatorship or you have a military government or you have a democracy or you have a king? What does Buddhism say about these things? And Buddhism, actually, if you look at how the Buddha deals with things of governance, what you have to do is you have to look at the Sangha. How is the Sangha governed? The Sangha is the monastic community, right? So how is the Sangha governed? And the Sangha is governed by democratic means. Yeah, everyone has a voice. Even the most junior monk has a voice. Yeah, even the most senior monk has to abide by the majority. Actually, not even majority, it's actually unanimity. Everyone has to agree. And if someone disagrees, you have to kind of find a way of getting them on board. Otherwise, you can't move forward. So Buddhist institutions, especially the Sangha, are governed by democratic principles. Yeah. And you may wonder why is this the case? And I think when you look at the scandals in the world of religion, you look at the scandals with the Catholic Church, you look at the scandals in Buddhist institutions around the world, in all religions, everywhere you find scandals. One of the biggest reasons why there are scandals is because you have these tremendous hierarchies, with some people being very powerful and other people being very vulnerable. There is an imbalance there, a very powerful imbalance. And the more of that hierarchy you have, the worse is the imbalance and the more abuse and problems you tend to have. Whereas a flat structure, a democratic structure, when no one is kind of taken to be like God Literally, yeah. Some of these people, they kind of say, yeah, I'm like God. Yeah, you better bow down to me. And it's almost like that in certain of these cults and things. It's kind of scary here. But when we all bow down to the Buddha, so the Buddha is the final teacher, we stand, in a sense, on an equal footing here. And when we use democratic principles to run our organizations, the Sangha, the Buddha Society here, one of the things we have been talking about is how to run the Buddha Society, the committee, should it be majority decisions, should it be unanimity? Yeah, and I have always been in favor of unanimity in all decisions because it brings everyone on board. No one feels like they lose out. Yeah, and there's much less chance of the majority oppressing the minority. Yeah? And this is what you get out of. You get out of all of these terrible abuses that you find in religion around the world. I think this is why the Buddha recommended a democratic way of running Buddhist institutions. And of course, if the Buddhist institutions should be run in this way, it makes sense that also our society should be run in this way. Yeah, instead of having one very strong person, usually a man at the top, yeah, being the one dictator, you can see how abuse can very easily happen in that kind of system. But if you're able to kick people out every 3 or 4 years, then there's less chance of that happening here. So, of course, this is getting closer to politics, yeah? And this is where you have to be very careful as a Buddhist monk. But the right time and the right place, I think it is okay to even to talk about such issues. So that was the first thing I wanted to talk about tonight, the issues in Myanmar. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about the kind of the social justice movements that we have been seeing around the world in recent years. Yeah, you had the Me Too movement going around the world. You had the Black Lives Matter happening, starting in the United States and spreading around pretty much around the globe. You have large social justice movements. And how do we think about that as Buddhists? Yeah, I've got to be careful with my words here because this is a dangerous minefield. Yeah, so whatever I say, it's probably going to say something wrong tonight. So please forgive me in advance before I whatever I say. So these are very important things. What are the basic Buddhist ideas on social justice? What do Buddhists believe in? And generally speaking, the Buddhist idea is a very equal treatment of everyone. A sense of equity for everyone is very fundamental to the Buddhist ideas. I just talked about before the democratic constitution of the Sangha. Yeah, that's one part of it. But one of the most astonishing things about Buddhism, and you may not even be aware of this, we have a very strong Buddhist nuns community here in Perth. Yeah, and this is actually really rare and very unusual. And you may not be aware of how rare and unusual it is. But what is interesting is that if you go back to the time of the Buddha is the one who started the nuns community. It was laid down all the way back then. Yeah, and so this is an ancient institution. So Buddhism, from the very beginning, has been one of the most equitous of religious organizations around the world. Most other organizations have been far more male-dominated. But Buddhism has had more sense of equity from the very beginning. And then the nuns order died out. And then we didn't have any nuns anymore. And then we had to restart it again. Yeah, especially within Theravada Buddhism. And it's kind of weird that we as an organization who had this equity from the very beginning, we were one of the last religions to kind of try to reestablish that equity. In parts of Christianity, it was established before Buddhism. So it's kind of weird, yeah, how we are kind of a little bit behind others, even though from the very beginning we had this kind of equality almost between monks and nuns. It shows you the power of different societies, how our societies influence our religion and how we interpret our religion. If you live in a liberal society, then the liberal values come out even in religion. If you live in a conservative society, then religion tends to follow the values of that society. Yeah? The general values in society are very powerful in shaping everything within that society. Yeah? So this is one of the first things of the Buddha. And the Buddha had some very beautiful things to say about this. You know, he said that there is no difference whether you are a man or a woman. Your chances of enlightenment is the same. Yeah, same human beings, the same human mind. It's the mind that gets enlightened. It doesn't make any difference. So, of course, we should give that opportunity to everyone. We can't exclude half of humanity from having that opportunity because it's such a beautiful thing. What we're giving is happiness to the world. What we're giving is wisdom, understanding, freedom from all the problems and the suffering of life. How can we hold back that from half of humanity? It's crazy. We can't do that. And so we here, as the Buddha Society, we also decided to jump on that. I was going to say bandwagon. I'm not sure if it is a bandwagon. It might be the wrong word, but you know, we decided that this is important. We need to do this. Yeah. So this equity, gender equity, really is at the foundation of Buddhism, and is something we should continue to develop in Buddhism. But it's not just a gender equity that is part of Buddhism. If you look at the way the Buddha talked about social status. Yeah, if you look, go to India. India is famous for all the castes, and the castes, very significant difference in social status. And the high caste, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. Yeah, at the time of the Buddha, there was only four castes. Now there's a billion jatis of various kinds. But still, the differences were enormous. And the Brahmins had all the kind of the good things. Yeah, they had the good jobs. They kind of lived were wealthy, and they kind of collected money. And they were also said to be light skinned. Yeah, there's another interesting thing. They were said to be light skinned, whereas those at the bottom of the hierarchy, yeah, they're kind of the swarthy offspring of Brahma's feet. The swarthy offspring of Brahma's feet. That's kind of what they were called. Yeah, they were born from Brahma's feet. And the Brahmins were born from Brahma's mouth. Yeah, whew, beautiful breath. Whereas the other ones, they were born from Brahma's soul. Yeah, and they were kind of dark and dodgy, and they had everything really hard in life. So very large social differences in ancient India. But when you ordained, when you become a Buddhist monk or Buddhist nun, everything was evened out. There was no right to discriminate anyone based on these kind of things. Yeah, social status, skin color, whatever it is. All of that was utterly irrelevant. The one thing that matters in Buddhism, the one thing that makes you, if you like, a superior person, if you can talk about that at all, is the fact that you are more virtuous. You are more wise. That is the thing that kind of lifts you up a little bit. Yeah, so that is when you kind of will be considered usually as superior in a certain way. But the weird thing is that if you are superior in that sense, it doesn't affect your ego. Yeah, the wiser you are, the less of an ego you have. The wiser you are, the less you think of yourself as superior at all. That kind of thing goes away. So even though in one sense, from a kind of objective perspective, standing back and looking at who is really useful in this world, who can help others, in one sense you are superior, internally you don't feel that anymore. That has gone. And precisely the fact that you don't feel superior is in a way what makes you superior. Yeah, because that is a superior way of thinking, not having the sense of comparison between people. You are less, I am more, I am equal. Equality is bad as well, right? Remember that. I'll come back to this maybe in a couple of minutes. We'll see what happens. Equality, no good. Superiority, no good. Inferiority, no good. So where does that leave us? Okay, I'll come back to this in a second, yeah? So this is the idea of no real grounds in Buddhism for discrimination of any sort. The Buddha was completely inclusive in his society. And sometimes the Buddha was not really a social reformer. The Buddha was more about the personal awakening of individual people. But sometimes it spilt into society as well. Sometimes it was asked, the Brahmins would come to him, yeah, because they were the kind of religious caste of India. And the Brahmins would come to the Buddha and they would say, yeah, you know, we are the Brahmins and these other ones, they are really dodgy, the lower castes, yeah. And then the Buddha would tell them, well, on what basis are you saying that, yeah? Is it true that if you are a Brahmin, you only Brahmins can be kind, but the lower caste cannot be kind? I've never thought about it like that before. You have a point, yeah? And then is it only the Brahmins who can have loving kindness and the lower caste cannot have loving kindness? Oh, yeah, yeah, you have a point. Yeah, you're talking sense. And gradually Buddha would bring people around to understand that the real qualities that really make you human, that really matters in human society, they are equally shared regardless of your social position, your gender, your skin color, whatever. These things have got nothing to do with it. And these are the things that really matter. The things of the heart, yeah? So sometimes he was a little bit of a social reformer because of that. So I'm just saying all of these things just to point out to you that in Buddhism, there is no basis for discrimination based on all of these superficial things that sometimes in the world we discriminate people with. There's no basis for that. Buddhism is a place where equity really should exist in all levels. And what a marvelous thing that is. And how disappointing it would be, yeah, if the Buddha said, yeah, they are low, yeah. And that would be very disappointing. I personally would feel that was devastating if that happened. And I might, I don't know if I would give up being a Buddhist, but maybe I would kind of write it off as a dodgy scripture or something. But, you know, that would be terrible if that was the case. But the Buddha actually doesn't just not do that. He says the exact opposite. Yeah, equity in society is very important. So what that means is that we should support social justice movements. Yeah, this is a Buddhist thing to do. If we see social justice movements in the world and we know that there are underlying problems of social justice, that there are discrimination in our society, and it's obvious that there is, at least to me it is obvious. That's how it seems, how the world seems to me, it's obvious. So for that reason, it's good to support these things and say, yeah, I'm on board with that, it makes sense. And to kind of a little voice sometimes can be a little bit of help to make these movements go in the right direction here. So there is a lot of suffering in the world because of social injustice. Yeah? But one of the strange things about the Buddha is that it doesn't really talk so much about that kind of suffering here. That kind of suffering, we talk about it now, has become very popular, talk about the suffering of social injustice around the world. So how come the Buddha didn't talk about it so much, if that actually is the case? What is the reason for that? I think the reason for that is that, according to Buddhism, there are also other kinds of suffering. Social injustice is not the only kind of suffering. It is one part of what it means to be human, one part of being discriminated against. But there is a much more fundamental kind of suffering that is true for all human beings. Yeah? And that is the suffering of just being human. The suffering we all have to deal with. Sicknesses, old age, dying. Yeah, when people die in your life, everyone tends to feel really bad when people die from us. When we have to die ourselves, it can be really hard. As the Buddha says, when we are separated from the things that we like and united with the things that we don't like, it can be very, very painful. And it happens on a daily basis, always small little sufferings. You try to meditate for half an hour, you feel a bit of restlessness, your mind goes all over the place. And a lot of that is also suffering and unpleasant. So there is a common fundamental suffering that we share, all of us as human beings. Everyone, regardless of where you come from, your background, your status, your privilege, whatever it is. And that foundational suffering is far more important than the suffering of discrimination. Because it is suffering which is always there and carries on, according to Buddhism, from life to life, on and on, yeah, for potentially forever, unless you deal with it. There is a big difference between these two kinds of suffering, because the suffering of social justice, if we focus too much on what separates us as human beings, if we think, I am the victim of social injustice, you are the oppressor, yeah? If we think too much like that, we divide our society enormously, and eventually it leads to conflict, it leads to violence even, if we think too much like that. We should think a little bit like that because we need to learn from our mistakes and move forward, but not too much. The beautiful thing about remembering the common human suffering of all of us is that it unites us. It brings us together. It reminds us that we are all brothers and sisters in the reality of life. We all have the basic fundamental problems in common. Yeah, there's no difference. It doesn't matter if you're a woman or a man, if you are from this country or that country, if you're rich or poor or educated or uneducated or intelligent or unintelligent or disabled or not disabled or short or tall or fat or thin, or all of these things are utterly irrelevant. We all have those things in common. And that becomes such a beautiful way of bringing us together, of understanding each other. Yeah, then we can start to have compassion for each other, loving kindness, because we understand the heart of other human beings around us, regardless of who they are. And this, to me, is such a more beautiful way of working than when we divide each other and we put, you know, set one group against another. You are my oppressor, and I am the victim or whatever. Sometimes there may be a kernel of truth to that. Yeah, some people are more oppressive than others. But it's not fruitful to think too much about that. More fruitful to think about our common humanity. And this is the thing I wanted to talk about. And I said that I wanted to talk a bit about we're not really equal either. Because there is a Buddhist way of thinking that makes us equal in a very much more fundamental way than we are just, you know, oh yeah, we are equal, we have the same rights. In a much more fundamental way than that. And when we talk about discrimination against people, this point of view is actually incredibly helpful. And that is to remember that according to Buddhism, we don't have an essence. There isn't any real me. Yeah. I could say, yeah, I was born in Norway and now I got Australian citizens. I'm half Norwegian, half Aussie. I'm a Buddhist monk. I got a shaven head. I could say all of these things and kind of create an identity out of that. But all of these things are impermanent. They're always changing. Yeah, we are not, there's no essence there, which is the real Ajahn Brahmali, the real Venerable Vasagha, the real Hokchin. Yeah, that essence is missing. We're always moving around. And because we're always moving around, we're always morphing from one kind of person into another one. And if you look at this in the long run, the long span from one life to another one, we're changing even our gender, our nationality, our intelligence, our status in society. All of these things are fluctuating all the time. So all of these expressions of being a human being, whatever skin color, whatever race, whatever education, whatever nationality, whatever gender, all of these things are already inside of us, waiting to come out. Get the right conditions, yeah, and they will come out, and you will be in the shoes of another person, almost exactly there. So when you are discriminating somebody, I'm not saying that you are doing that, of course, but if you were discriminating someone, you're actually discriminating yourself, because it is already inside of you. It is already there waiting to come out. And if you keep on doing that, one day when that comes out in you, well, then you are very likely to be discriminated against in the same way. So when you have compassion for other people who may be discriminated against, you also have compassion for yourself, because you know one day you too will have that form. You too will be in those shoes. Yeah. And when you think about it like that, it kind of opens up the possibility of compassion and care and kindness in an entirely new way. We're always moving around, always changing, moving from one thing to another. And this is why we're not superior, because one day you're here, one day you're there, nor are we inferior because we move back and forth, but nor are we equal because there is nothing to measure by. Yeah, we're just changing all the time. We're not really equal in the sense of, a simplistic idea of equality. But we are equal in a much more profound sense, in the sense that we're always changing, always moving around, morphing from one thing into not something else. You can never really compare yourself to anyone. It's a beautiful teaching. And this then becomes a beautiful foundation for building up and to be a Buddhist, in the idea of the social justice movement, seeing yourself in other people, seeing other people in yourself, looking yourself in the mirror and seeing yourself as all of these other people, and understanding that there is no difference there. At root, we are all in the same boat. We're human beings going around this samsaric journey, suffering in a way we don't really understand, trying to get out of it, trying to emerge from it. So let us help each other in emerging from that suffering, yeah, in whatever way we can, whether it is through social justice, as I've been saying now, but also ultimately in the more profound sense of practicing the Buddhist path itself. And when we do that, we can all work in harmony, yeah, in a positive way, in a much better way than we normally do in this world. Okay, so that's it for tonight. So, enough. Does anyone want to comment on this or complain about what I've said or disagree or anything like that? please grab the microphone if you kind of really want to say something here. If not, then that's okay too. Yeah, don't have to say anything here. It's really up to you. Anyone? Ron over here. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. Yes, Ron, please, fire away.
Thank you very much for what you had to say tonight. And I'm reminded that today is the day in which Jesus was crucified. And it was the power, the religious powers, the secular powers, were afraid that his loving way would attract people too much.
Mm.
And so he was got rid of.
Yeah.
One of the words that comes for me is, when the power of love overcomes the love of power, then things will really move.
So right.
Thank you for what you have to
say. That's a beautiful saying, yeah, when the power of love overcomes the love of power. That's a nice one there. Yeah, so there's always going to be probably a bit of conflict between secular power and religious teachings, yeah, because it kind of undermines sometimes the secular power. I think that's a good point, yeah. Okay, anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. No? Okay, good. Thank you for not saying anything, because no, I'm just joking. I'm happy. Whatever you do, I'm fine with that, yeah, but... So we have a couple of, actually four questions from overseas. And one is from Tirani in the UAE. The UAE is in the Middle East. That's very cool. So, dear Ajahn, can females become Buddha? If not, why? Thank you. Okay, this is one of those controversial questions. Can females become a Buddha? And first of all, the most important thing is that females can become fully enlightened in exactly the same way as males. So that is the most important thing, because a Buddha is a bit more kind of rare, yeah? And I wouldn't recommend anyone to try to become a Buddha anyway, because that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught us to become enlightened, not to become a Buddha. There isn't really any obvious path to become a Buddha, but there is a very clear path to become enlightened. But back to your question, can women become Buddhas? And the answer is, it is uncertain. If you read some of the suttas that we find in the Pali Canon, they say specifically women cannot. But remember that these suttas are not always 100% reliable, because the suttas, for a large part, they are the word of the Buddha himself. But some of the suttas came in later on, and you can know that through what they call text criticism, whereby you analyze the text, the various layers of text, the language used, the ideas, and all of these kind of things. And there are some studies that suggest that the idea that women cannot become a Buddha is a later addition to the Pali Canon that came out of Indian society. Indian society has traditionally been very patriarchal, yeah, very strong male domination traditionally in Indian society. So you can see why that idea might seep in from society at large and color the Buddhist texts. Yeah, so I would say it is uncertain, but I think anyway it's irrelevant. Yeah, one of the things about being a Buddha, you don't really have a gender anymore. So you kind of go beyond the idea of gender. But I cannot see any reason why not. I think that quite possibly that idea is a later thing. But don't worry too much about it, because you're going to become an arahant instead, right? Yes, no need to worry about it. So just go for the arahant path, and then you're in business. Okay, so next one is from Marine in Germany. Hello, Marine. Dear Ajahn, my family and friends are musicians like me. It unites us strongly. I want to keep the 8 precepts. If they ask me to join in and sing or visit their concerts, I will hurt their feelings and cause suffering. What should I do? Okay, you should go, yeah? Go with your family, go and hang out with them, have loving kindness for these close friends of yours. It's so important to have that. If you go because you do it out of compassion and kindness, I say you're not really breaking the precept. You're breaking the precept because you want simply going to indulge. That is when you're breaking the precept. If you do it for other reasons, it is no problem. It is very common for us as monks, we're not supposed to watch television and all of these kind of things. When I go back and visit my mum, I will often sit down and watch the news with her on TV or something like that. Yeah, if she watches something which is a bit kind of really over the top, then okay, I say, mum, I'm going to take leave, thank you. And she's okay and has no problem with that. But you do these things not because you necessarily want to see those things, but simply out of kindness and compassion. So absolutely, I order you to go and do those things. And you don't have to follow my orders if you don't want to. Anyway. So, next one is from Satira, also in UAE. Okay, UAE. Gee, you're really onto this. That's marvelous. Dear Ajahn, is there any circumstance where the Buddha would ever approve of violence? Suppose a situation where Buddhism is at risk of disappearing and there is a need for war in order to stop that from happening. Would the Buddha approve? Absolutely not. There is no way that the disappearance of Buddhism can be stopped by war. It will make it disappear even faster. Buddhism is the expression, how we live it out. That is what Buddhism is. If we defend Buddhism through violence, we're doing the exact opposite of what we should be doing. Buddhism should be defended through how we live our life. It should be an inspiration to other people. That is when we are most likely to support Buddhism for the future. So that's no, absolutely no grounds at all for violence. And sometimes this is exactly the kind of arguments you hear. We have to, you know, get rid of these other people, the Muslims or whatever, because they're invading our country, they're degrading our Buddhists. It's the wrong way to think. Yeah, Muslims are also human beings. They have feelings like everyone else. They just have a different religion or whatever. But it is not the right way to persecute them. It's not going to work. This is the fastest way to destroying the good name of Buddhism in the world, if we start acting in this way. So the answer is absolutely not. Is there any time when violence is approved by the Buddha? The answer is yes. Ha, got you. I saw you shaking your head. Okay, so got you now. Yeah, so you always wait and see how people react, and then you say, ha, got you. Sorry, I apologize. I don't mean to embarrass you. I just was being very naughty here. So is there? And the Buddha says yes. And the Buddha says, I allow you to kill one thing, monks. There's one thing I allow you to kill. What is that one thing? Anger. Your defilements. Yeah, anger. I allow you to kill anger. Yeah. If we eliminate anger from our lives, that is one of the things you're allowed to kill. But apart from that, stay away from killing. Stay away from violence. It does not work. Anyway, that's my opinion. And the sutta, what is interesting, I didn't really say enough about the suttas. If you read the suttas of the Buddha, one of the things that come out of those suttas is the integrity they have. Yeah, there's nothing in those suttas that in any way can be construed as supporting violence. Nothing. It's absolutely astonishing. If you take almost any other religious book, any other book around the world, there's always something you can find in that might be construed in that way. But the early Buddhist suttas are devoid of it, absolutely devoid. There's an integrity to the teaching that is absolutely astonishing. And this is one of the reasons why I have such incredible faith in the Buddhist path, because of that sense of integrity, which is so strong. So that's why I mentioned when there was a famous monk in Burma who said to the army, yeah, violence is okay according to certain scriptures. And the scripture that he had to cite to be able to say that was a history book. Yeah, it was a history of Sri Lanka. It's called the Mahavamsa, a very famous book in Sri Lanka, Mahavamsa. And he pointed, well, in the Mahavamsa, there was an ancient king in Sri Lanka, and he killed all of these people. And then he asked the monks, and the monks said, yeah, they're not really people, yeah, because they are not Buddhist and whatever, something like that. Really awful story. And then he said, well, that is a precedent. It's okay. Yeah, it's crazy thing here. But it's not coming, it's not the word of the Buddha. It's got nothing to do with Buddhist doctrine. It's a history book about what happened in ancient Sri Lanka. It is not something we can use to justify these things. And still, that's how desperate they become, because there's nothing else to use in Buddhism. So Buddhist teaching have incredible integrity when it comes to not oppressing anyone, not harming anyone. Yeah, this is a very interesting idea in Buddhism, not to be harmful. It means you should be considerate. Yeah, it should be not be ruthless. You should be ruthful. That's a word, by the way. I was very proud. I found this word in a dictionary. It was used back in the 17th century in England. Ruthful, the opposite of ruthless. Full of ruth, full of compassion. Yeah, ruth means compassion. So we should be compassionate. We should not be inconsiderate. Even being inconsiderate is bad. Yeah. Why? Because being inconsiderate basically means that you prioritize your greed and your desires over the consequences that greed has for other people. That's why it is bad karma. Okay, anyway, I'm getting really sidetracked. So let's come to the last question here for tonight from Yong Ji An in Singapore. Bante, how do we deal with obsessive thinking, like planning for the future obsessively here? Remember that the future is uncertain. The future that you are planning for is guaranteed not to happen anyway. I remember myself when I was at university, I was planning for the future and I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to have a girlfriend like this. I'm going to have a good house, really nice house, yeah, like that. This kind of career I'm going to have, yeah, really nice career. Actually, I got a really nice career. So that one worked out. Yeah, I'm going to have these kind of things or whatever. And of course, all of that, I ended up like this instead. Yeah, and so that was a bit of a... So the future is just so incredibly uncertain. So don't worry about the future. The future will happen. The best way to create a good future is not by thinking about it. The best way to create a good future is by living well now. Make good karma now. Be kind now. That kindness that you do now in the present moment, that will ensure that you have a good future. And that is a very good reason for focusing on the present rather than focusing, obsessively planning about the future. Yeah. So remember these simple things. But if your thinking is very obsessive, it could be that, you know, your mind really wants to go there. The mind doesn't want to be in the present moment. Maybe because you have some suffering in your life or whatever. So in that case, you have to overcome that suffering first of all. Yeah. Come back to the more simple things on the path. Don't try too hard to meditate, because you will probably fail if you try too hard. Come back to the simple things. Be a kind person. Have a good heart. Be compassionate. Be generous. Yeah, live that life more fully. Think kind thoughts about the people around you. Think how fortunate you are to be part of a Buddhist society. I don't know if you are in Singapore. Probably you are. Yeah, part of a Buddhist society with so many well-intended people. They're not perfect, perhaps. They're well-intended. Otherwise, they wouldn't come to places like a Buddhist society. What's the point of coming here if you want to be a scallywag? There's no point. Yeah? Bank robbers. How many bank robbers in here? No bank robbers. Yeah? That proves the point. Yeah? And this is the thing. People who come to places like this are here precisely because they basically are good people. So focus on that. Build those qualities up. And as you do that, your mind will gradually change. It will become less obsessive. You will naturally become more mindful because you feel good about yourself. Yeah. So one of the critical things on the Buddhist path is to know what to focus on, because certain things are not going to work for everybody. You have to know where you're at and what you need to do. That is such an important thing. And some people are not ready to meditate, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with not being able to meditate. You're not kind of a loser or anything like that in Buddhism because you can't meditate. It's just part of the human condition. Sometimes that's not going to work, so you wait, you put it off, you do other things instead. You come back to meditation later on when you are ready for it. That is the right way to think. Anyway, I wish you good luck and hope you can overcome those problems. That is all for tonight, everyone. Very nice to see you all. So let's all pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha together here.
Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagava. Bhagavan Tang Abhivade Me. Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namasami.